Blog Talk Radio.
Folks, welcome to Right from the Left Coast. My name is Linda, and welcome Rod and Ron to the show. Hopefully others will show up. I am coming at you from Oceanside, California. It's gorgeous, 67 degrees. It's clear, sunny, and I couldn't be happier on that front. And I want to get to the news of California, but before I do that, I have to give a shout out to Hollis Buchanan, of course, and we're praying for him and his family. And everybody in Georgia that got hurt or messed up by the weather down there, and apparently Tennessee. So also, we are brought to us by PatriotFamilies.com, and our friend Hollis, of course, has set up the site and the Blog Talk Radio Patriot Family site, so we want to shout out to all them. Please come to our site. We've got so much stuff. You couldn't get through it in a week. Great people, great patriots, great true constitutional conservatives, we'll put it that way. Basically, I have to get these out to you guys for those whom I have emails for. I did send Bill some stuff because he's real interested in the Agenda 21 stuff. What I saw, I took a lot of time with these emails from my Americans Protecting Property Rights here regarding the Agenda 21 stuff, and they send me stuff all the time, and it's just awesome. It took a long time to go through, and I'm not even finished with all the videos. But in Siskiyou County up north, the Central Valley, the Delta area, these people are fighting against these EPA people, the conservative, enviro status wackos, I call them, the wildlife associations, the fish and game. They're fighting all of it, and they're winning. And what I've said, what Rosa Curie said, what Tom DeWeese and even Glenn Beck has said, if you want to tackle any of this, whether it's, forget the feds, they're coming at us from all fronts. They're just evil. And I'm going to get to that later as well. You have to go local. There are two meetings this week. I'm going after this show to the Oceanside City Council meeting to fight against. There's two points on the, we're trying to fight on this Agenda 21 stuff tonight, after this show, and then tomorrow night there's like probably 10 of us coming from Oceanside carpooling up to Escondido. We're fighting against this Gregory landfill. It's insanity, you guys. It's all Agenda 21, and we are fighting it. Now, many of the people that I'm traveling with do not have one inkling as to what this is. They don't understand ICLEI. They don't understand the globalists, you know, agenda. They have no clue. But I have a whole article on that today. I've got plenty of time, thank God, because I have a lot to give you. This email that came from my friends at the Anti-Agenda 21 Task Force here in town, it's amazing. There was like six or seven people on this panel. Some were lawyers, some were sheriffs, some were concerned citizens, property owners, farm owners. They're dealing with every issue from timber to logging, to water rights, to building stuff on your land, utilizing property. I mean, and the one guy who gave a speech, I'm going to try to get this to you guys probably tomorrow or the next day by email, and you can go through these videos. They are astounding, and it is positive proof that you do it locally and you win, because the guy who was taking all these cases to court, they actually, some of them go all the way to the Supreme Court, and they win. At least they win on the first level. Sometimes they go to the appellate courts and they lose. They just keep going and they just keep winning. And it's just very inspirational that people who stand up against this tyranny, against these encroachments on every single property right issue, every single amendment right issue, our unalienable rights, we can win this, guys. And that's why I'm fighting, because it's truly amazing. There was one gentleman from, he was trying to deal with the timber and logging issues in his state, and that was Arizona. I think it's called Apache, Arizona. And he had like a good 10 or 11 minute speech that he got to give on these different clips that were presented to me. and they're actually winning. The sheriff runs. We have to fight that big. We have to build a bigger steamroller, is what I'm saying. And believe me, I'm doing it. And I'm so glad to see the other gentleman up there. And the people from Siskiyou County, Sheriff Lopey was not there at that particular meeting, but I actually met him in person, sat right next to him, got to listen to him speak at the Oath Keepers meeting in Orange County. And that was just a privilege and an honor. Sheriff Mack was there as well. There was about 300 people in the audience. And at the end of that little meeting that I got to have the privilege to attend, we all stood up and took the oath of, you know, to defend the Constitution against foreign. And it was amazing. So it can be done, and I will try to get those to you as soon as possible. We're going crazy here with these people. What I wanted to do is go, this was Friday, January 25th, 2013. This was my local paper, and this, they had a huge amount of backlash, I guess. Somebody got to, probably the sponsors for the golfer Phil Mickelson, who's made his name, you know, he's made a lot of money, and he's an excellent golfer, a great guy. He's just a family man. He lives in San Diego, I believe, here in California. And he was coming out and saying he wanted to bail because of these high taxes. And I'm going to get to that article on Jerry Brown in a minute, but I want to give you this one. And then after they forced him to apologize, Tiger Woods came to his defense, because Tiger in 1996 exited California for the very, very same reasons, because they were, you know, raping him of his money. And he went to Florida, and people are going to Nevada, and people with not big names are bailing out of this state left and right. And I'm glad, because the garbage that you're going to hear after this article is going to blow your mind. And Tiger said, I don't blame him. He says he shouldn't have apologized. He said, I did it in 1996 for the very same reasons. It's ridiculous. So it says, the headline was, Phil has it right on taxes. No need for an apology. And let's see, I think this was done by Scott Kaplan, whoever's the author. It says, Phil should not apologize. Shocking. The amount of reaction to Phil Mickelson's commentary on taxes. Why the venom toward Phil? Regardless of your financial situation, you get it, right? Phil is at the top of an industry that is highly lucrative, and when you are especially when you're a champion, moreover, being a champion and generally likable character, the endorsement money flows in. When you make a ton of money and you see how much you have to pay in taxes, at some point you look for a more advantageous solution. Tiger Woods did, and he admitted as much. So why the apology? Phil says because he shouldn't have used the forum of a golf press conference to express a political opinion. And this author says, why not? This is golf. Most of the fans of the game feel the same way he does. I get it. Many of us have hit hard times, in particular in the last few years. However, in Phil's world, this is the way he thinks. Most people are tired of being so heavily taxed, especially here in California. Oh, boy, will you hear the next article. Have you checked your pay stub recently and seen the additional payroll taxes taken out? We all feel the pain of taxes. Phil had the guts to say something. And the next thing you know, he is forced into an apology he clearly didn't want to make. Don't apologize, Phil. We all get it. You're rich. No need to apologize. And that's the end of that article. And I was, voting them out. Well, I live in a blue state, and probably 70% of these morons don't get it. But I'll tell you something, they're going to when they keep feeling the pinch. Like I said, I predicted this a long time ago. This is going to be a ghost state. There's going to be nothing but takers here, and the illegals are going to bail because there's no jobs and no money. This was the same day, Friday, January 25th, in my Union Tribune San Diego. Oh, you can't even believe who owns these papers anymore. I'm telling you, all that's fit to wrap fish in is this page. This is a headline with ugly Il Duce, Jerry Brown. It says, Brown presents upbeat outlook. This is going to astound you. In his State of the State address, Governor lauds Californians for enduring tough times. Associated Press, Sacramento, Governor Jerry Brown gave a sweeping State of the State address Thursday, saying California has confounded our critics by emerging from a fiscal netherworld and is now positioned to handle big projects again. Oh boy, wait till you hear this one. The governor stressed the need for fiscal discipline while laying out an ambitious agenda that calls for investing in high-speed rail, more Agenda 21, and the largest upgrade to the state's water delivery system, another Agenda 21 piece of garbage, in decades, while overhauling the state's relationship with school districts to stress local control. Yeah, I doubt that, Jerry. The Democratic governor delivered his address just months after voters, this is what happens here, the voters approved his Proposition 30, which raised sales and upper-end income taxes temporarily. Have you ever seen a temporary tax and is expected to generate $6 billion a year in additional revenue? But it's not going to when everybody leaves the state, fool. Brown used much of his speech to congratulate voters and lawmakers for having an optimistic vision of California. I think I'll throw up. Do we have barf bags here, Mom? He promised an end to the deep budget deficits that have plagued lawmakers and governors for years. Against, quote, against those who take pleasure singing of our demise, California did the impossible. Brown's speech was filled with soaring rhetoric and historical references that are hallmarks of his addresses, from the biblical story of Pharaoh's dream about fat and lean cows emerging from the river to the Spanish adventurers who forged north into modern-day California. Yeah, this guy's delusional. I'm telling you, absolutely delusional. He broke little new ground, but did announce a trade mission to China in April, and the one in the White House, and call for a special legislative session to implement the Federal Affordable Care Act by next January. Yeah, Assembly Majority Leader Tony Atkins, Democrats of Summits of San Diego. We're replete with Democrats now. They have a supermajority in Sacramento. Isn't that special? Applauded the optimistic tone, but cautioned that tough work was still ahead. We have a positive outlook, but it doesn't mean that the job is any easier, she said. I guess this Tony Atkins is a woman. Following the speech, it means our challenges are focused in a different way. Brown had previously addressed the main topics of his speech. Those include changing K-12 education funding, the need for higher education systems to hold down costs, promotion of the $68 billion high-speed rail system, continued need to combat climate change, here we go, and building massive twin water tunnels under the Sacramento San Joaquin Delta at a cost of $14 billion. This man is crazy. For the 70, this is how old this creep is, the 74-year-old Brown, it was his 11th such speech. He served as governor from 1975 to 1983 in the era before term limits, before being elected to his latest term in 2010. Quote, this is Governor Brown, I have never been more excited, he said. 2 years ago, they were writing our obituary. It's not done yet, Jerry. Well, it didn't happen. California is back. Its budget is balanced, and we are on the move. I don't know what planet this man is on. He must be in Jupiter. Despite the big-ticket projects Brown sees as a priority, he urged the legislature to rein in its temptation to add burdensome regulations and to practice fiscal restraint with the additional tax money approved by voters. Yeah, that's going to happen. We have Pelosi. We have Waters. Oh, yeah, that's going to happen. Republicans reacted favorably to the governor's live within our means message to the legislature, where Democrats won supermajorities in both houses last November. That would allow them to pass tax increases without Republican support if they choose. We have a governor who is speaking Republican language, embracing long-held Republican principles, said Senator Jim Nielsen, Republican of, I guess, Gerber County. Senate Republican Leader Bob Huff of Diamond Bar shared those sentiments, but he added, he talks fiscal conservatism, but the reality is the budget increases 25% in the next 3 years. Left relatively powerless, Republicans have taken a somewhat conciliatory approach to the governor in the first month of the new legislative session. Well, anyway, I'm going to kind of bore you with the it's just garbage. So what we're dealing with is, you know, a governor who's gone. That's why I call him Il Duce. He's just insane. So I want to go to the other one. I'm going to try to do tomorrow in the morning. I'll get you guys that thing on Siskiyou County and stuff. It's just phenomenal what these guys have done and what they're doing. And the gentleman who was from Arizona actually won their case. They made sure that the area that they were dealing with the timber and the forests in Apache, basically they have told any federal agency, including all the national forest people, all these wildlands people, the EPA, that if anybody comes in and tries to stop them from doing what they want to do, they're going to be arrested. And I was just sitting here watching it and applauding. So what we deal with is huge amounts of global power, and I want to go through this as fast as I can, and I'll take calls in a few minutes, but I just wanted to get this to you guys. This was about the global elites. It says, many dismiss those who believe in a global conspiracy as cranks and fools, and yet evidence that such a conspiracy exists is fairly easy to establish. One definition of conspiracy reads as follows: a secret agreement between two or more people to perform an unlawful act. God, sounds like our government for 130 years. That is okay as far as it goes, but it does not even begin to capture the breadth and scope of the globalist agenda. Once you define it correctly, it starts to look less like a conspiracy and more like a business plan, which is exactly what it is. A secret agreement by a number of super-rich elite families to increase their wealth and power on the world stage by covert means, with a view ultimately to impose a unified world government under their control and to employ a range of subversive techniques and programs in diverse fields: political, financial, economic, military, industrial, medical, educational, religious, and media-related, among others, to achieve this objective. The super rich families and those who support them are known by various names, including the power elite, the ruling elite, the cabal of international bankers, the Illuminati, the globalists, and the black nobility. One can even think of them as the trillionaires club. It is, in essence, an agreement among the like-minded people who are seeking to establish a global monopoly on the commodity they value more than any other: power. Given human nature and its dismal record of murder and corruption, it would be truly astonishing if a group like this of this kind did not exist. The question we should be asking. So instead of asking, does a global conspiracy exist? We should really be asking, what are these power-obsessed, ultra-wealthy people actually planning to do, and what are the likely consequences for the rest of humanity? It's not good. The following published quotations by members of the global elite should go a long way towards dispelling any doubts you may have about their existence. They should also shed considerable light on their mindset, their methodology, their contempt for humanity, and the remarkably sophisticated nature of their plan to destroy the sovereignty of independent nations, namely us, and create a new world order. They are so arrogant and so confident of that success that from time to time, some of their more outspoken members divulge just a little too much information about their intentions. The United States is the principal target. I'm going to go back to see. I have to toggle back and forth to see if anyone's calling in, but that's okay. If you're living in the United States, you need to be especially concerned about the global elite, since the last major obstacle to a one world government is the United States itself. As a sovereign, independent nation, and the foremost player in world affairs with a long tradition of liberty and democracy, the globalists believe it cannot be allowed to continue in its existing form. They have long planned to weaken it fatally, a process which is now at a very advanced stage, and destroy its sovereignty. A totalitarian regime of some kind is scheduled to take over, possibly on foot of an engineered national crisis, and then abolish the Constitution. The America that has existed since 1776 will then disappear forever. Well, we're pretty close. Please consider the evidence for yourself. More than 40% of your industrial base has been offshored, with most of it given lock, stock, and barrel to a Marxist-Leninist regime known as China, using a host of deceitful practices in the banking system. Successive governments have left the country saddled with such staggering levels of debt at household, corporate, state, and federal level, not to mention massive unfunded liabilities such as Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare, that there is not the slightest chance that even a fraction of it can be paid down from future taxation without destroying the economy. In fact, it is so great and growing at such an alarming rate that your great nation will very shortly be unable to even service its debt, i.e. keep up its interest payments to foreign and domestic lenders. Industrial employment across the U.S. as a whole has been radically reduced, and most of the jobs that remain are in the low-paying, insecure services sector. The erosion of your civil liberties since 9/11 has been so severe that any law-abiding American can now be picked up and incarcerated indefinitely by his government on vaguely worded security-related charges against which he or she has absolutely no defense. It can't happen here, you say. Really? The following quotations prove otherwise. Not only is it coming down the tracks, but the pace of decay is now such that a severe economic collapse in the next 2 to 3 years is looking increasingly likely. A major admission by the globalists in 2009. I'm going to get to that in a second. Okay, good. Just want to go on. Let's start with the astonishing admission by the globalists in 2009. It can actually be found on the official website of the Council on Foreign Relations. Oh, they're such a nice entity, which is one of the several obscure institutions that secretly run the United States. Thank you for that wonderful tribute to Henry Kissinger yesterday. Congratulations. As the most recent National Security Advisor of the United States, I take my daily orders from Dr. Kissinger. We have, filtered down through General Brent Scowcroft and Sandy Berger, who is also here. We have a chain of command in the National Security Council that exists today. These remarks were done by the U.S. National Security Advisor James L. Jones at the 45th Munich Conference on Security Policy at this hotel in February 2009. This is probably the most public and most brazen confirmation to date by the globalist elite that they control the U.S. government. James Jones was appointed through the democratic process approved by Congress, but here he is stating categorically that he takes his orders daily from Henry Kissinger via two other unelected officials, Brent Scowcroft and Sandy Berger. Kissinger is a well-known mouthpiece for David Rockefeller. Many regard him as the author of several brutal wars and genocidal campaigns. He has been given no mandate whatever by the American people, and yet, as Jones confirms, he has direct control over U.S. national security. German Chancellor explains how a global elite controls everything. Let's turn now to Helmut Schmidt, who was German Chancellor, Prime Minister for 8 years in 1974 through 1982. In his memoirs, Men and Powers, Random House, 1987, he wrote that American foreign policy is decided by two groups, the establishment and the Council on Foreign Relations. One was a large number of outstanding career diplomats and career officials in high positions who provided continuity. The other was a large reservoir of discerning private persons who were committed to foreign affairs and who had already served earlier administrations. This reservoir, earlier frequently called the establishment, has both its forum and its center in the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. Its members were lawyers, bankers, some industrialists, and academics. The Council published and still publishes the excellent periodical Foreign Affairs. Quote, the Council on Foreign Relations successfully drew carefully chosen young people into its discussions and prepared them at first for modest tasks. In the course of their careers, they often took on top-level missions in the State Department, the Pentagon, the White House, or other centers of international policy, from trade agreements to disarmament. the foreign policy elite, which had very silent but effective ways of seeing it to its own succession, was thus largely a matter of the East Coast. The power of the CFR is well illustrated by the extraordinary number of top government positions that have been filled by its members. 7 presidents, 7 vice presidents, 17 secretaries of state, 19 secretaries of defense, 17 secretaries of the treasury, and 14 directors of the CIA. He then went on to describe 2 other organizations which skeptics often dismiss as paper tigers invented by conspiracy theorists. That would be you and me. The Bilderberg Group. I gratefully recall the yearly so-called Bilderberg conferences that Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands organized and ran, and the yearly meetings of the London Institute for Strategic Studies under the leadership of Alistair Buchan. Some of the United States senators active in foreign affairs always participated in these 2 to 3 day international conferences. Conversations with Dean Acheson, George Kennan, and Paul Nitz, which might occur during such meetings, were a treasure trove of information and enlightenment. We were not surprised whenever, a few years later, one or another of the men we had had such good conversations with reappeared as a cabinet member or deputy secretary or head of a department. In such cases, we could safely assume that the man's views were the same ones he had espoused in our earlier talks. He then confirms the existence of an unelected power elite who advise, i.e. control, the elected politicians. So these unelected politicians, a class of professional intellectual politicians who never run for office but offer their services to the elected politicians and the candidates, at times even force them on them as expert advisors and executive officers. They are supported by various institutions where they work whenever they are not in government service. Schmidt proceeds to name some of these institutions: the Brookings Institution, the American Enterprise Institute, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, the Georgetown Center for Strategy, the International Studies, the Hoover Institute, the Heritage Foundation, and the RAND Corporation. In the course of his review of American power brokers, Schmidt named several of these unelected professional intellectual politicians, including some who are still in power today, nearly 40 years later: David Rockefeller, Henry Kissinger, and Brzezinski, the first name I can't do. The incredible unseen influence of David Rockefeller. James Jones may answer to Henry Kissinger, but Kissinger in turn answers to David Rockefeller. Okay, just let me get through this, guys, because this is really important. In the following published quotations, Rockefeller makes no attempt to hide his globalist agenda, his Marxist beliefs, or his evident willingness to destroy the sovereignty of the United States. For more than a century, ideological extremists at either end of the political spectrum have seized upon well-publicized incidents to attack the Rockefeller family for the inordinate influence they claim we wield over American political and economic institutions. Some even believe we are part of a secret cabal working against the best interests of the United States, characterizing my family and me as internationalists and of conspiring with others around the world to build a more integrated global political and economic structure, one world, if you will. If that's the charge, I stand guilty, and I am proud of it. David Rockefeller Memoirs, Random House, 2002. One is impressed immediately by the sense of national harmony. There is a very real and pervasive dedication to Chairman Mao and Maoist principles. Whatever the price of the Chinese Revolution, it has obviously succeeded not only in producing more efficient and dedicated administration, but also in fostering high morale and community of purpose. The enormous social advances of China have benefited greatly from the singleness of ideology and purpose. The social experiment of China under Chairman Mao's leadership is one of the most important and successful in human history, quote by David Rockefeller, New York Times, August 1973. At which time Rockefeller was chairman of the board of Chase Manhattan Bank. We are grateful to, this is another quote, to the Washington Post, the New York Times, Time Magazine, and other great publications, whose directors have attended our meetings and respected their promise of discretion for almost 40 years, it would have been impossible for us to develop our plan for the world if we had been subject to the bright lights of publicity during those years. But the work is now much more sophisticated and prepared to march towards a world government. The supernatural national sovereignty of an intellectual elite and world bankers is surely preferable to the national autodetermination practiced in past centuries. That's also 1991, David Rockefeller, and this was at a meeting of Bilderberg Group in Baden-Baden, Germany. Note how far-reaching his ambitions are. The imposition of world government and the replacement of autodetermination, or a democracy with a constitutional republic, by an elite group of intellectuals. He even admits to being part of a secret cabal to bring this about. If you're tempted to think the globalist aims of this secret cabal are not actually being implemented on the world stage by their political puppets, then please consider the boast by Madeleine Albright at a major public function in 1997 when she was serving as U.S. Secretary of State. Today, there is no Stalin to give orders. If a nation is isolated from the international community now, it is either because the country is simply too weak to meet international standards or because its leaders have chosen willfully to disregard those standards. Last week in the Netherlands, President Clinton said that no democratic nation in Europe would be left out of the transatlantic community. Today I say that no nation in the world need be left out of the global system we are constructing. That was 1997. That was Harvard University commencement address in Massachusetts. Some courageous attempts to sound a warning. A few elected representatives have tried to warn of the dangers posed by the globalists, but with little success. Unless the mainstream media highlight their words, they pass largely unnoticed by the vast majority of people. For example, the United Nations and the Trilateral Commission were set up specifically to promote the goal of globalism and dilute the sovereignty of independent nations. Yet warnings by people of the stature of Senator Barry Goldwater, who was the Republican presidential nominee in 1964, received very little popular attention. Quote, "The time has come to recognize the United Nations for the anti-American, anti-freedom organization that it has become." This is Barry speaking. "The time," Goldwater, not Barry V., "the time has come for us to cut off all financial help, withdraw as a member, and ask the United Nations to find headquarters located outside the United States that is more in keeping with the philosophy of the majority of voting members, someplace like Moscow or Peking." That was 1971. Here's another one from Barry Goldwater. "The Trilateral Commission is intended to be the vehicle for multinational consolidation of the commercial and banking interests by seizing control of the political government of the United States. The Trilateral Commission represents a skillful, coordinated effort to seize control and consolidate the four centers of power, political, monetary, intellectual, and ecclesiastical. What the Trilateral Commission intends is to create a worldwide economic power superior to the political governments of the nation states involved. As managers and creators of the system, they will rule the future." That was 1979, from his book With No Apologies. "From time to time, a politician does emerge whose words of warning reach the mainstream media or who manages in some manner to cause problems for the globalists. When this happens, they often meet with an untimely end. For example, even allowing for their above average number of their air miles, an unusual number of senators, congressmen, and state governors have died in airplane accidents, by my reckoning, more than 30 in the period between 1950 and 2000, compared to 1 in 20,000 for the population as a whole. A notable member of this unfortunate group was Congressman Larry McDonald, a very vocal critic of the globalists and their disturbing agenda. Quote, and to my knowledge, not one has dared to reveal the most vital part of the Rockefeller story, that the Rockefellers and their allies have, for at least 50 years, been carefully following a plan to use their economic power to gain political control, first of America and then the rest of the world." And he goes on, "Do I mean conspiracy? Yes, I do. I am convinced there is such a plot, international in scope, generations old in planning, and incredibly evil in the intent. You will find the truth often surprising, sometimes unpleasant, and always vital in the pages that follow. Gary Allen has done a masterful job of combining the hundreds of scattered facts and hidden clues of the Rockefeller puzzle until one unmistakable pattern emerges. The picture that is revealed when the Rockefeller file is finally opened may shock you. In this book, you will learn why the Rockefellers follow the policies they do, what their goals are, where they intend to take America, and why it is essential they be stopped. This was Congressman McDonald, Introduction to Rockefeller File by Gary Allen in 1976. Congressman McDonald was killed when the Soviet Union inexplicably shot down the large passenger plane in which he was traveling on September 1, 1983. This was Jerry Falwell, Washington Post, September 2, 1983, quote, "There is a real question in my mind that the Soviets may have actually murdered 269 passengers and crew on the Korean Airlines flight 007 in order to kill Larry McDonald." Wouldn't surprise me a bit. So it goes on there. I'm going to go back to the studio for a second. Okay. Give me a few minutes. This is really good stuff. The Georgetown professor reveals too much. Okay. Oh, I want to welcome FT and Oz and guests, and thank you guys for joining me. I'm almost done with this one, and I'm going to take some calls. The globalists made remarkable, if accidental, disclosure of their long-term program in 1966 with the publication of a major academic work by a historian at Georgetown University, Professor Carol Quigley. In his massive volume, over 12,000 pages in length, Professor Quigley revealed for the first time the way leading figures in the British and American establishment have conspired together for decades to create a global empire of greater power and scope than any in history. And here are some telling excerpts. Quote, this is from Professor Quigley in 66. "There does exist and has existed for a generation an international Anglophile network which operates to some extent in the way the radical right believes the communists act. In fact, this network, which we may identify as the Roundtable Groups, has no aversion to cooperating with the communists or any other groups, and frequently does so. I know of the operations of this network because I have studied it for 20 years and was permitted for 2 years in the early 60s to examine its papers and secret records. I have no aversion to it or to most of its aims, and have for much of my life been close to it and to many of its instruments. I have objected both in the past and recently to a few of its policies, but in general, my chief difference of opinion is that it wishes to remain unknown, and I believe its role in history is significant enough to be known." And he goes on, "The powers of," let me get this scrolled down, "financial capitalism had another far-reaching aim, nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands and to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. The system was to be controlled in a feudalist fashion by the central banks of the world acting in concert. By secret agreements arrived at in frequent private meetings and conferences, the apex of the system was to be the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, a private bank owned and controlled by the world's central banks, which were themselves private corporations. Each central bank sought to dominate its government by its ability to control treasury loans, to manipulate foreign exchanges, to influence the level of economic activity in the country, and to influence cooperative politicians by subsequent economic rewards in the business world." That was 1966. He also cites a famous remark by Walter Rathenau, a former foreign minister of Germany. Let me go on here. Oops, I lost it. Okay, hold on 1 second. Okay. Okay, here we go. I'm sorry. I need to do that. Let's see if there's exceptional covert. I hit the wrong thing. Financial work, Macmillan. To be known. I'm so sorry. Okay. Publication, Georgetown, Quigley, the powers. I'm almost there. Sorry. Here it is. A relatively small number of bankers were in positions of immense influence in European and American economic life. As early as 1909, Walter Rathenau, who was in a position to know since he had inherited from his father control of the German General Electric Company and held scores of directorships himself, said, 300 men, all of whom know one another, direct the economic destiny of Europe and choose their successors from among themselves. Quigley, who taught the future president Bill Clinton during his student days, was fairly candid about the forces that shaped the past, but was careful not to reveal too much information about the continued existence and covert operations of the same secret cabal. Why the globalists are prepared to kill millions of people. The globalists have an exceptionally ambitious plan, namely to impose a centralized form of government on the planet as a whole. This is fully consistent with the world political situation prophesied in the Book of Revelation, which envisages the formation of 10 regional authorities across the globe and the subsequent emergence of one all-powerful world ruler. The globalists brought about two world wars to advance their agenda. The first broke up the old empires of Europe and the Middle East, while the second laid the foundation for the European Union, NATO, and the United Nations, and the consolidation of two vast communist regimes, the USSR and China. For purposes of our analysis, the key point to note is that together, these two devastating wars resulted in the cruel and violent deaths of over 75 million people. Both were extended for as long as possible for maximum effect, with the international financiers, the globalists, providing funding and weaponry to both sides. All the indications are that they intended to initiate another world war sometime in the next few years in order to lift their global agenda to the next level. Human life means nothing to people who believe they are superior to the rest of humanity. Over the past two centuries, they have developed a scientific philosophy which, in their eyes, justifies the elimination of large swaths of humanity. The inferior stock, from an evolutionary standpoint, deserve to be eliminated. Most of this philosophy was developed in Britain and exported to the U.S. and Germany. It continued to spread and expand until today. It permeates the globalist mindset. They are convinced that left to its own devices, the world's population would grow to the point where the very survival of humanity would be under threat. Inferior human stock is breeding exponentially and must be restrained. The only way to do this and prevent the destruction of the world's limited resources is through mass murder and sterilization. Great guys. If this seems utterly improbable, think again. Some of the most respected intellectuals in British society in the last century were vocal proponents of this view. Consider, for example, the following remark by H.G. Wells, "And for the rest, those swarms of black and brown and dirty white and yellow people who do not come into the new needs of efficiency, well, the world is a world, not a charitable institution, and I take it they will have to go. The whole tenor and meaning of the world, as I see it, is that they have to go. So as far as they fail to develop sane, vigorous, and distinctive personalities for the great world of the future, it is their portion to die out and disappear." That was 1902. These depraved ideas have long held sway in British establishment circles and have been taught, usually covertly, in the leading British universities such as Oxford, Cambridge, and the London School of Economics. They were in turn transmitted to the most influential centers of learning in the United States, including Harvard, Princeton, and Yale, as well as the principal universities in Germany such as Heidelberg, Freiburg, and Leipzig. The Nazi eugenics program, which was funded and encouraged by the globalists, grew directly from this school of thought. The globalists recognized that many white Europeans will resist the New World Order and its program of ethnic cleansing, you think? H.G. Wells makes it quite clear that all such resistance must be dealt with summarily, in summary fashion, and malcontents eliminated. This is a quote from H.G. Wells in 1939. "When the struggle seems to be drifting definitely towards a world social democracy, there may be still very great delays and disappointments before it becomes an efficient and beneficent world system. Countless people will hate the New World Order and will die protesting against it. When we attempt to evaluate its promise. We have to bear in mind the distress of a generation or so of malcontents, many of them quite gallant and graceful-looking people. The rich list scam, even where one accepts that this globalist philosophy exists, it is legitimate to ask whether the people concerned have both the means and opportunity to put it into effect. It is only necessary to look at the pattern set in the 20th century and ask why so many undesirable outcomes, every one which has been set in motion by a small group of influential people, just happen to advance the globalist agenda. Extremely costly and highly destructive wars funded from the same source, the progressive creation of international bodies to dilute the power of sovereign states, the rampant spread of atheistic doctrines in science, philosophy, and religion, the massive expansion of communism, the use of fiat currencies to impoverish the middle class of developed economies, the staggering increase in the power of private international corporations, the high level of surveillance in so-called free societies, the development of a disturbing array of weapons, biological, chemical, nuclear, and genetically engineered, to intimidate and destroy, and the highly sophisticated use of popular media for propaganda purposes. That's all very well, you may argue, but all of this takes money, extraordinary amounts of money. What evidence is there that a small elite actually have the financial resources to execute such an elaborate plan? According to the Forbes Rich List and similar lists published by other leading publications, the richest individuals in the world are worth no more than $50 billion each. Men like Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, Larry Ellison, Carlos Hilu, Lakshmi Mittal, etc. But these lists are a total fraud. They omit the super rich, the small group of families in Europe and America whose wealth is simply prodigious. The super rich in 1900 did not lose their wealth in the course of the 20th century. Perhaps a few stalled along the way, but most prospered to a dazzling degree. In his official biography of the Rothschilds family, Frederick Morton reckoned that their total wealth was over $6 billion in 1850, the Rothschilds' Portrait of a Dynasty, 1962, given that this was an authorized biography of a secretive family and that they would have no particular desire to exaggerate their wealth. This figure is probably on the conservative side. If we increase this wealth with an annual real rate between 5% and 6%, which is probably an underestimate, given their influence over the markets, and their wealth today is well in excess of $30 trillion, or twice America's annual GDP. Yet how many members of the Rothschilds family featured on the Forbes Rich List, or on any other rich list for that matter? Where are the Rockefellers, the Mellons, the Astors, the Vanderbilts, the Carnegies, the Cecils, the Cargills, Bronfmans, the DuPonts, the Harrimans, the Phipps, the Gettys, Guggenheims, the Dawes and Biddles, and dozens more in the United States, Britain, Germany, France, Switzerland, Italy, and so forth? And what is the true wealth of the ancient royal families of Europe, whose combined stock and real estate holdings must run into the trillions? Please consider these facts carefully, since they reveal a great deal about true center of power in the world today. If we assume that the next 10 families on the real rich list, not the ones published by Forbes, have just been as successful as the Rothschilds expanding their own wealth over the last 100 years or so, then we could safely add another $30 trillion to the total wealth enjoyed by the world's ruling elite. The published list of the world's richest people are designed to conceal the identities of the truly wealthy, the all-powerful elite. After all, if you have wealth of this magnitude, you don't want the world to know about it. Bill Gates is a shoeshine boy besides the Rothschild family. The truth is that an elite set of ultra-rich families rule the greatest nations on earth. Their political influence operates with impunity on a global scale and is directed toward one overall objective, namely the creation of a centralized world government controlled on their behalf by a chosen cadre of frontmen and puppets. This goal cannot be achieved without large-scale reconfiguration of the United States, which in turn requires its subjugation by political and economic forces beyond its control. For the past 100 years, the noose has been tightening, particularly since the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913, a privately owned monopoly on the issuance of all U.S. dollars. The key figure in the globalist agenda is the President of the United States. The powers of the U.S. President, who is nothing more than a pawn in the hands of the ruling elite, have been steadily enhanced in a very low-key manner, at the point where in a state of national emergency, he could rule with absolute dictatorial authority. Look at the evidence under a range of executive orders that have been signed into law during the past 60 years or so without any input from Congress. Successive presidents have authorized the transfers of extraordinary powers to their executive office during a state of national emergency. Most Americans are unaware of these powers or their extent. Neither are they aware that it is President himself who decides whether or not a state of national emergency ought to be declared. Thus, at the stroke of a pen, Congress can be suspended and the sweeping executive powers assumed by the president. An attempt was made by a Senate committee in 1973 to audit these powers and to raise awareness generally of their extent. The forward to the committee's report was published in 1973. The joint chairman took the unusual steps of issuing a statement on September 30th, 1973, anticipating the ominous points made in the forward. The president has the power to seize property, organize and control the means of production, seize commodities, assign military forces abroad, call reserve forces amounting to 2.5 million men to duty, institute martial law, seize and control all means of transportation, regulate all private enterprise, restrict travel, and in a plethora of particular ways, control the lives of all Americans. Most of these laws remain a potential source of virtually unlimited power for a president should he choose to activate them. It is possible that some future president could exercise this vast authority and attempt to place the United States under authoritarian rule. While the danger of a dictatorship arises through legal means may seem remote to us today, recent history records Hitler seizing control through the use of emergency power provisions contained in the laws of the Weimar Republic. That was published in Maryland in 1973. The various executive orders in existence at that time clearly conferred extraordinary powers on the president and allow him, if he so wishes, to operate a dictatorship, just as Senators Church and Mathias had warned. Many other executive orders have been made since then, which add greatly to the powers which the president may exercise during a state of national emergency. Please remember that these do not include the exceptional powers already conferred on the president under a long list of statutes, including subsidiary provisions in otherwise innocuous acts. For example, President Obama signed an executive order 2009-13524 regarding the privileges and immunities of Interpol on U.S. soil. Interpol is a private international police organization with a very shady past. Former Interpol presidents include SS General Otto Steinhausel, Reinhard Heydrich, one of the senior Nazi officers most responsible for the Holocaust, SS General Arthur Nebe, under whose command at least 46,000 people were murdered, and SS General Ernest Kaltenbrunner, who was condemned to execution at the Nuremberg trials. The definition of Interpol published by the U.S. Department of Justice in 1988 ought to ring an alarm bell in every state across America. Interpol conducts intergovernmental activities but is not based on an international treaty, convention, or similar legal documents. It was founded upon a constitution drawn up and written by a group of police officers who did not submit it for diplomatic signatures, nor have they ever submitted it for ratification by governments. That was 2006. John Coleman, Institute of Human Relations. The changes made by President Obama in December of 2009 extend to Interpol the same privileges and immunities under the International Organizations Immunities Act of 1945 that apply to organizations which the U.S. has approved either through international treaty or a vote of Congress. Whatever restrictions applied to it under previous Executive Order 12425, signed by President Reagan on June 16, 1983, were completely removed by Obama. This is a truly astonishing concession in that it allows a private international police organization to operate anywhere on American soil with virtually no federal supervision or constraints of any kind, except where the president decides to revoke it, its special status. Neither Congress nor the American people had any say in any of this. In short, Interpol enjoys the same immunity from every form of judicial process as is enjoyed by foreign governments. The big difference, of course, is that foreign governments are not authorized to operate covert intelligence gathering operations on American soil, but Interpol is. The fact that there is no consolidated statement of the extensive powers that the president may exercise during a state of national emergency ought to be a matter of great concern, both to American citizens and to the world at large. And that's the end of that one. And I'll take calls anytime, but I have more. So I'm so sorry that others have logged out. keep fighting. Okay, so I've got Oz, and I'd love to have you call in, Oz. So anyway, I'm going to go back through this. Where have we got? That was a great piece. And so what I'm looking at with that is that all the presidents from the inception of these evil ones, and probably after, starting with Lincoln or before, are controlled by these elitists. And this is very concerning. So I'm going to probably do this show for a little bit longer. We had last week, and I didn't get to finish it because we had some great phone calls. I don't know what he was talking about. Constitution. Yeah, the rights. Anyway, thank you, too, for still remaining. I know a lot of people probably got bored with that piece, but I found it compelling, and I was sent it off to my friend Bill Strong. I went through, it's called The Communist Infiltration of American Churches from 1887 to 2012. And there are two of these councils, and one is called the World Council of Churches and the National Council of Churches, and they're both evil. Exposed in 1960 in the United States House of Representatives was a pamphlet bibliography of 260 children's books authored by known communists, which had been published by the National Council's Department of Racial and Cultural Relations in 1957. Alfred S. Kramer stated in the foreword, "We of the National Council consider these books safe to recommend to children." Of course he would. One book by Langston Hughes contained an outrageous poem named Goodbye Christ. In 1964 was the year of NCC's Commission on Religion and Race sponsored a youth ministry consultation in the Methodist General Board in Education in Nashville, Tennessee, to enlist young people in violent political agitations, telling them they must be bloodied in disorders for the cause of racial equality, that they were slaves to their parents, and they must be freed from this bondage, and if stopped by police, they should be proud. Here we should remember a few of Stalin's instructions. Give these teenagers drugs, alcohol, praise their wildness, strangle him with sex, give him complete freedom everywhere. If we kill the national pride and patriotism of just one generation, we will have won the country. And that was Joseph Stalin. And it goes on. If anyone would like to call in, please do 646-378-0321. There is so much going on. I'm glad you guys joined me, and you probably missed the first part of the show. And I do have one place I'd like to go. I'm going to play a clip for you, and then we'll do this one. It's actually based on the Founding Fathers' battle, the gun grabbers from the grave. So this is about, I'll just give it about 4 minutes, and I hope you guys enjoy this, because this was really cool. The whole piece is almost 10 minutes, but I'm going to go the whole way. This is about the Second Amendment. So here we go. Let's see if I can play it.
The Second Amendment to the Constitution, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed.
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 The Founding Fathers agree. Armed citizens make good government.
I ask, sir, what is the militia? It is the whole people.
Who is the militia? Are they not ourselves?
To disarm the people, that is the best and most effective way to enslave them. George Mason.
Congress have no power to disarm the militia. Their swords and every other terrible implement of the soldier are the birthright of an American. Tench Cox, 1788.
The Constitution preserves the advantage of being armed, which Americans possess over the people of almost every other nation, where the governments are afraid to trust the people with arms. James Madison, Federalist, number 46.
A free people ought not only to be armed and disciplined, but they should have sufficient arms and ammunition to maintain a status of independence from any who might attempt to abuse them, which would include their own government. George Washington.
The Founding Fathers created the Bill of Rights, enshrined individual protections, including the Second Amendment, because they understood that power inherently corrupts. The Bill of Rights was set up to try to discourage bad behavior from government, try to further restrain it, and try to head off what they knew would eventually become misinterpretations of the law and attempts to misconstrue the intent of the founders. But their quotes here could not be more clear.
If the representatives of the people betray their constituents, there is then no recourse left but in the exertion of that original right of self-defense, which is paramount to all positive forms of government. Alexander Hamilton, The Federalist, number 28.
Are we at last brought to such a humiliating and debasing degradation that we cannot be trusted with arms for our own defense? Patrick Henry.
The Constitution shall never be construed to authorize Congress to prevent the people of the United States, who are peaceable citizens, from keeping their own arms. Samuel Adams.
The right of citizens to bear arms is just one more guarantee against arbitrary government, one more safeguard against the tyranny which now appears remote in America, but which historically has proved to be always possible. Hubert Humphrey, 1960.
When governments fear the people, there is liberty. When the people fear the government, there is tyranny. The strongest reason for the people to retain the right to keep and bear arms is, as a last resort, to protect themselves against tyranny in government. Thomas Jefferson.
Thanks, guys. I just wanted you to hear that it goes on for quite a few more minutes, but thanks for joining me. I'm going to cut it short because I do have a meeting to go fight the evil ones down here in Oceanside. They're so clueless. And thanks, Oz and FT, for hanging in there. And I'm going to put one more little clip just to say God bless and good night. And this is from Braveheart, and I love it. It's one of my favorite. You guys have a great one. And Oz is typing, but I can't see what he's doing yet. Hang in there.
You think the people of this country exist to provide you with position. I think your position exists to provide those people with freedom.
You guys, I'm going to sign off, and I hope to see you next week. I'm going to go through my communist infiltration of American churches and a few other things. We've really got to get going, and I want to make sure I get down to the city hall tonight and give them hell, or at least find out what's going on, and hopefully I can speak for my 3 minutes. Love you guys. Take care, and I'll see you next week.